How did you get from software to your interest in the space elevator?
Well, I've always been a science fiction fan, and one of my favorite authors was Arthur C. Clarke. And I read his Fountains of Paradise many, many years ago. And the idea of a space elevator always stuck in my head. It just seemed so obviously right. It was just the right way to get up, you know, into space out of Earth's gravity well. And I retired several years ago, and one of the things that I decided to spend more time learning about was the space elevator. And there were some blogs and some sites, but they weren't being kept up. They were just terribly out of date. So I said, well, you know, somebody should start pulling this information together.
Now, at this point, were we, would you say, into the kind of modern era of the development of this concept?
Yeah, this was in April of 06.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, very much so.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had read some of the new books, especially the Brad Edwards book about it. And so, like I say, I found these websites, but nothing seemed to be up to date, and it was just painful to find out what was currently going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided, well, let me start pulling this stuff together and put it up on a blog and just see, maybe other people might be interested in it too.
So as you began to learn about what I just called the modern era of this concept, because the concept as described in Arthur Clarke's book is quite different from what's emerging now in some ways, right?
Yeah, in some ways it is, and some ways it isn't. And actually, one of my ideas for a blog post down in the future is to compare what he thought of, you know, how, what his conception was versus what, you know, the modern day Dr. Edwards' conception is.
Why don't you give us your best shot at that right now? That'd be a very good lead into this.
Okay, there's several. He had located his space elevator port on the island of Sri Lanka. He had, for novel reasons, had moved it south to the equator. You know, and it doesn't really sit on the equator. It's close to it, but it's not. But basically, he said that there would be a land port. Current thinking is that there's going to be an ocean-going port,
mm-hmm.
So that you can move the base of the space elevator if you need to basically get the space elevator out of the way of satellites and other things that are in orbit.
And apparently, that's not an if. That's a when.
Yeah, exactly. There's stuff up there, and it's going to get, you know, it's going to intersect where a space elevator is, and you have to do something about it.
Right.
And what Dr. Edwards has proposed is that you actually move the space elevator, inducing a wave up into the space of elevator, so it zigs, you know, when the object going by is zagging, so it stays out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly one large difference.
And the object being moved in this case, just so we're clear, is on the order of a 100,000-kilometer strand of material.
That's correct. It's a carbon nanotube tether or rope or ribbon or whatever term you want to give to it, and that is anchored at one end at an earth port, something like an ocean-going oil platform. You can think of it that way, at the earth end and up at a counterweight up in, 100,000 kilometers up above the earth's surface. And so by moving one end, you can induce a wave that will travel up the ribbon. And since you know where these objects are in space, at least the big ones that you have to worry about, you can track these carefully. You know what's going on in the ribbon because you'll have sensors in the ribbon. You'll have climbers on the ribbon, which will indicate where they are. And you should be able to always move the ribbon to get it out of the way of something coming by, which would be dangerous.
So one difference from Clarke's original vision was that the platform is mobile and sea-based. What are the other differences?
The cost. I mean, he had talked about the cost of the space elevator. I just reread the book a little while ago, something about like the Earth's gross national product for a year or two, or some enormous number like that. And a number now which looks more realistic is on the order of $10 billion.
And what accounts for that big difference?
I just think more knowledge now about how it's going to be built.
Maurice and I talked about this a little bit, and his take on it was that the Clarke assumption was that you're going to need an enormous amount of mass parked up in geosynchronous orbit, and that to lift all of that mass was going to be tremendously expensive. And so I think that actually ties into another evolution of the concept, which is that it's not now anchored with a large mass at 22,000 miles, but extends far beyond that.
That's correct. It's something up on 100,000 kilometers, and you know the weights that the Edwards plan is a counterweight of about 600 tons, metric tons, you know, which is quite a bit smaller than the Clarke scenario.
And the reason that's possible is?
Well, because it's farther out into orbit.
Yes.
Well, I shouldn't say anything. Well, it is orbit. It's hard to say something that's attached to Earth is in an orbit. I mean, that's just kind of a semantic issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 100,000 kilometers above the surface of the Earth.
At its endpoint.
At its endpoint, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the cost is a second difference. I guess those are the two big ones. I mean, he had talked about the material being some sort of carbon monofilament or diamond monofilament. And so that's, in a way, with a little literary license, it's somewhat similar to a carbon nanotube. It's the same basic material.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually going to consider that. It's this, you know, he was right on that one rather than being wrong on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was more along the order of that one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he hadn't talked about powering the climbers at all. The one example he gave at the end where Vannevar Morgan is going up the ribbon to try to rescue some people up there, it was a battery-powered issue.
Mm.
And certainly in the Edwards concept, it's going to be a laser-powered. You know, lasers will be aimed at some photovoltaic cells on the bottom of the climber, and then that'll be turned into electricity.
So the climber is the robot that is attached to the tether and is the thing that ascends.
That's correct. I mean, they're called climbers, they're called cruisers, they're called railroad cars. There's a lot of different terminologies, but I think climber is probably the most often used.
Okay. You know, I've heard this phrase, carbon nanotube, and I have some sense of what one of those things is, i.e. it's a sheet of carbon atoms that's basically folded into a cylinder.
That's correct. It's theoretically, at least with what we know today, the strongest material possible.
But, you know, there's kind of this conceptual gap between, okay, I can imagine a small sheet of this stuff folded into a cylinder, but then how that gets translated into 100,000-mile-long cable, and not just in terms of the inherent strength of the material, but how is it composed, right? What is that, you know, what is the architecture of that cable?
It's composed of fibers. I mean, when you buy a rope at a store, you know, and it's, you know, 50 feet long or 100 feet long, you know, there's no fiber in there that's 50 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
They're all much shorter, and they're woven together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's going to happen with carbon nanotubes also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, the length of them is you know, the longest ones that I know of that I've actually seen are on the order of 5, 10, 15 millimeters long.
Mm-hmm.
Though there is at least one web report out there of some Army lab that's made one 30 centimeters long. I'd like to see some more information about that.
These would be individual fibers.
That's correct.
Right.
So you know, one of the issues here which has got to be solved is to grow a longer fiber. And
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of people who are working on that. There's a couple of different types of technologies. The MIT team is working with MIT space elevator team is working with a company called NanoComp.
Okay, so you're going to need to make a longer fiber, but there are going to be obvious limits on how far you can go in that dimension. And so then we get into sort of the next level of the architecture, which is how you start to compose a thicker rope of these out of strands, right?
Right.
And then there's going to be probably multiple levels to that architecture, just like the Golden Gate Bridge cables are multi-stranded at, I think, 3 or even 4 levels of hierarchy, right?
Right, that's correct. And actually, that's a good way to look at it. I mean, the textile mills are very good at this kind of stuff. If you give them fibers, they will weave you cables. You know, the issue is going to be able to give them carbon nanotube fibers of sufficient length and strength that they can weave into a good cable. And, you know, that's where the bottleneck is right now, is making that. Once that problem is solved, that should be the last conceptual technical hurdle that has to be overcome. Everything else is engineering.
What kind of diameter of cable are we talking about here?
It depends on which scenario you're looking at. If you're looking at the Edwards scenario, it's going to be a ribbon which, after it's completed, is going to be roughly 20 inches wide, maybe a little wider, maybe a little narrower, and it's going to be a ribbon.
Why a ribbon?
One, it was just thought that that's what climbers would climb up on, would be a ribbon. More importantly is when you're in space, you know, you want something that's got as wide a surface area as possible. So if it's hit by a micrometeorite, it doesn't sever the ribbon. All it does is it pokes a hole in it. And if you have it woven correctly, that strain is taken up by nearby fibers.
Okay.
So what may happen, though, because out of the atmosphere, a ribbon becomes, a curved ribbon becomes the ideal form. But in the Earth's atmosphere, it actually causes a problem because of wind issues.
Yes.
So in Earth's atmosphere, it may be a cable widening out to a ribbon as it leaves the atmosphere something along that line.
Okay. Now, presumably, there needs to be a procedure for maintenance and repair of segments. And so what's being discussed along those lines?
Some people have talked about trying to actually turn the tether itself into a big loop. Okay, and so it's constantly being rotated down to the Earth, and so segments would be replaced at that point.
Huh.
That's nice in theory. That causes other issues because basically you've doubled the length of it.
Yep.
Because you got to have it down and you got to have it up. And then what do you do about the issue of turning into a cable in Earth's atmosphere and a ribbon back up into outer space?
Mm-hmm.
But being able to do that maintenance on Earth has got a lot of obvious advantages. You know, all of your staff is right there. The tether may be made of segments. Okay, and so another scenario is that segments would be replaced because when one of the things that people are afraid of is what happens when the ribbon is cut, like all of a sudden there's going to be this snap and everything's going to go flying.
Mm-hmm.
That's really not what's going to happen. When it's cut, the two ends are essentially going to sit there for some time. They'll start to gradually pull apart, but it's not going to be like a snapping cable.
Not catastrophic?
No, not catastrophic, as long as you get to it in time.
Huh.
So you should be able to disconnect and reconnect segments. And then the climber cars going up and down are another possibility of being able to repair a cable.
Uh-huh.
That might be just some sort of like automated robotic task that happens as the climber goes up. It's reweaving threads or reweaving, fibers into the cable. So there are several scenarios. Which one is going to be used, only time's going to tell.
Carbon nanotube technology, the laser power beaming technology. Those appear to be the kind of the crucial ingredients that are kind of in development and prototype right now, as I understand it, because you have this, there is this space elevator games, which tests those two kinds of components, right?
Correct, that's right. And those, again, are scheduled this year for October sometime at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The carbon nanotube, there's just a lot of development work going on right now by industry and by universities and by some individuals, too, I'm sure. And there's just so much money being pumped into carbon nanotube research, not even to build a space elevator.
Yeah, not only for this purpose. It would obviously be.
And not even a majority. I mean, most people who are working on this don't know about a space elevator or don't care about a space elevator.
Right.
They just see a market for something which is, many, many, many times stronger than steel and many, many times lighter than steel.
Yeah.
Everything from sporting equipment to bridges to police vests to, the market is endless.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people doing a lot of research on this. And with some of the results that are coming out now of nanotubes being measured at 2, 4, 6, maybe even 8 gigapascals, and these are magnitude jumps over a couple years ago, there's a real sense now that we're getting close, within the next couple of years of actually being able to make a carbon nanotube ribbon strong enough to support an elevator.
How strong is that, right? Like, what are the forces acting on this thing calculated to be, and what is necessary to resist those forces?
It depends on the scenario that you're using. The original Edwards scenario, published in his book several years ago, I think was 130 gigapascals, something like that. That's how strong the ribbon would have to be and have a safety factor of 2. Since then, there's been some rethinking of that, and people, some good aerospace engineers believe that this number can be dropped to 40 or maybe even 60 gigapascals and still provide a sufficient safety margin for that. And so it's a lot easier to get from 8 to 60 than it is from 8 to 130, of course, which doesn't mean 130 is out of the realm of possibility, but we're going to get to 60 before we get to 100.
But those existing results are for radically shorter lengths of material.
That's correct. They've got to be long enough, and they've got to be strong enough.
Yeah.
But again, you don't have to make something which is 100,000 kilometers long. You just need something long enough that the textile companies can string it into a fiber.
Yeah, but then, having done so, ropes stretch.
That's correct.
And we don't have any examples of 100,000 kilometer ropes or cables or anything remotely close to that. So like the physics of a rope or cable at those kinds of lengths, it seems to my mind, it's kind of unimaginable.
Well, the total amount of cable, example, in the San Francisco Bay Bridge will exceed the length of the space elevator.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. So, I mean, there are experiences with long cables. Now, it's different, of course, because it goes back and forth and they're wrapped around things. But if you take the total number of miles in San Francisco Bridge cable, it will exceed 100,000 kilometers.
Really?
Yes.
So huh.
There are some experiences with that, but, again, it's not the same. It's not 100,000 kilometers in one direction, and I'm not saying that problem is solved, but there is some experience with it.
So in terms of the laser power beaming, then, is this also a case where development is occurring for all sorts of other reasons, and a spin-off will be that it could be used for this project?
Yeah, exactly. You know, NASA sponsors these space elevator games, and they've put up $4 million for this, but they really don't care about space elevators. You know, they care about very strong materials, i.e. carbon nanotubes and tethers, and they care about power beaming.
Uh-huh.
And so, because they see applications for it, and so there's, you know, there's going to be development down there totally unrelated to the space elevator. You know, Boeing has just come out with a solid-state laser, which is in the, I think, the 25-megawatt range, and they say that they can produce one in 100-megawatt range. And if you can get 20 of those, that's enough to power your climbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, the technology is getting close to that. There's already gas lasers, which are strong enough, but people would rather use the solid-state lasers. I'm told by Dr. Edwards that the solid-state lasers are just more satisfactory, easier to maintain. And so the fact that Boeing is now one quarter of the way there on one of these lasers is a pretty promising development also.
And what are the current applications for those?
Well, power beaming, if you've got applications like, for example, a moon buggy, you may not want to be able to carry batteries when the thing is running all over the moon. You'd like to be able to beam power to it. If you want to have airships that can stay up for, you know, weeks at a time, you don't want it to be have to carry fuel. It won't be able to. You'd like to be able to beam power to it.
Mm.
So they have their own needs for it, totally unrelated to a space elevator.
Mm-hmm. And are any of those concepts reality at this point?
No, they're not. They're just that. They're concepts, but they're needs.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to develop the technology to satisfy those needs.
Mm-hmm. And I gather that there was some consideration of what might be a showstopper, which is the defense of the elevator, both from natural and man-made attack.
Actually, that wasn't discussed too much at the conference. I mean, what was discussed was the natural, you know, issues that are going to affect a space elevator, mostly things like micrometeorites, but there's also atomic oxygen.
Space junk.
Space junk, yeah, exactly. And so something is going to have to be done about that. And that's being, I guess, addressed in two major ways. One is you design the tether, the ribbon, in such a way that the small pieces, the worst thing that will happen is they'll punch holes in there, and then there is a lifetime where you can replace those tethers, which are gradually degrading. And then the other one is the large pieces, which if they hit the space elevator, would be catastrophic. And what you do in those cases is you move the space elevator out of the way.
The computational challenge of doing that is one that dovetails actually with Microsoft's interests and capabilities, and so that, you know, that might actually be one interesting outcome of Microsoft's having hosted and sponsored the conference, is that there are some interesting computational grand challenges, if you will, there.
I would hope so. We'd love to have Microsoft behind something like that. That would be great.
So give us a sense of, you know, who was there and what was discussed and what seemed to emerge from this year's conference.
Well, I think there was, I guess there would be two answers to that. There were a lot of people who are, I guess, old pros in the space elevator industry. You know, people who have been working on this for years and years and years and have come up with the initial concepts and solutions to the initial problems. And then there are, you know, some new people who have just shown up in the last 8 months, 10 months, a year. You know, some people were invited and some people just showed up. There's an effort that's underway now to try to make this an international crusade, an international campaign to try to get a space elevator built. We have this concept, you know, it's certainly not original to the space elevator, but it's something we've adopted, of the four pillars, where you, to get any huge infrastructure built, you need technical capabilities and a technical solution. You need a business plan. You need the legal issues, insurability taken care of, and then you need the public to be able to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been tried before, and it really hasn't succeeded to set up a sustained four-pillar effort to work on this. And this year we think we've done something differently in the fact that we've just been able to get the enthusiasm and especially the international support to have the four pillars go forward is a very sustained effort. This is something that people should be hearing more about in the next month or so. So there was people who, like I say, the old pros, and then there was people who just want to get involved. and get involved into this four-pillar effort. We've also got participation now, very strong participation from the Japanese and also from the Europeans, so that we're hoping between the three of us and maybe some others that we can enlist that we'll have enough international resources to make this a sustained effort.
You know, it's interesting that we were speaking about the Golden Gate Bridge, and I hadn't really known this until I watched a documentary on the construction of the bridge. But evidently, it was not a federally funded project. It was a municipal project, which I find really kind of amazing. And so this ideally, I think, would go in a similar way, right? It wouldn't necessarily be a big government kind of thing at all. And
yeah, I don't think it has to be. You know, one of the talks that was given this year was one I gave on who I thought would build the first Earth-based space elevator. And there are a lot of different entities that could do that. I mean, $10 billion, you know, yes, is a lot of money, but there's a lot of groups out there that can raise or have $10 billion.
Yeah.
So you know, money, while it's an issue, is not going to be the showstopper here. But I do think that you're going to need a government involved somewhere along the line for defense, because there are other crazies out there that are going to try to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And also for insurability issues. You know, who's going to go to the United Nations and negotiate the treaties? Because some treaties are going to have to be changed. Maybe some new treaties are going to have to be written. And I think a government behind that is going to have a lot easier time to get that done than just, you know, eight companies come together as a consortium and say to the United Nations, we want to build this.
Right.
You know, I don't think they're going to let just companies do it. So I could see, you know, one of the scenarios I could see is a group of U.S. businesses getting together, you know, once this carbon nanotube problem is solved, and saying to the United States government, we will take the financial risk, we will take the technical risk. In return, please defend our elevator. And please, you know, help us deal with the insurability and legal issues, and we'll make you a deal. You know, if you do this for us, we'll give you 5 free launches a year or 10% off in every launch or something. You know, I'm sure there's a deal that can be made there.
In terms of making the case for why to do this, right, obviously everyone who's involved in this concept takes it on faith that it would be a good thing to do for all sorts of compelling reasons.
Yes.
In practical terms, it kind of comes down to, all right, well, there are, in fact, a set of applications. To me, I think the one that seems potentially most compelling is another sort of concept still in development very much, which would be the solar satellite concept.
Correct.
And it kind of ties into the power beaming technology, because that's how you'd get the power down to Earth from orbital solar cells, right? So from the perspective of this group, is that the application that they tend to lead with?
There are a lot of people who do. You know, I don't personally, because I'm still a bit skeptical of the technology. I just think that not of the technology, but of the fact that, you know, we on Earth use so much energy. I mean, we just use enormous, humongous amounts of energy.
Yep.
That to throw enough stuff up into space to turn it in and create, you know, space-based solar power from that to make a significant dent in our energy usage on Earth, you know, the amount of material we're talking about is just enormous. It's just huge. And so I'm just, you know, we're not going to have a space elevator for another 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, you know, our energy problems are going to get much worse.
Mm-hmm.
We may have some, you know, some pilot projects up there launched by rockets, but there's going to be nothing up there that's going to power your refrigerators or my computer or anything like that. That's mm-hmm. way down the road.
Or have any significant effect on greenhouse gas emissions in the foreseeable future.
That's correct. I mean, it's just, you know, it's still too far away, and you need to put too much stuff up there. You know, having said that, the concept is outstanding, you know, and may be something that's going to happen. But I just don't think right now it's you know, I'm still just a bit skeptical of it.
Okay.
But I'm in the minority there.
Oh, you are?
Yes,
okay.
Most people, I think, will tell you that that's a huge reason why we should build a space elevator.
Okay. And then what are the other reasons that come up?
Well, look at what a space elevator gives you. I mean, it gives you enormous capacity, it gives you low cost, it gives you safer launches, and it's environmentally friendly. You're not, you know, rockets generate a lot of pollution. And so a space elevator gives you all of those things. So any industry, any need which can take advantage of that is going to want to use a space elevator.
Right, but so the issue becomes what are those, right? What are those needs?
Well, the biggest one right now, I think, that people are actually making money on are communication satellites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a big and growing industry for communication satellites right now. And satellites have to be made very, very robust, because because right now they have to survive a rocket launch. You know, on a space elevator, they won't have to survive that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be much cheaper to send up a satellite, you know, on a space elevator than it is on a rocket.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is going to be orbital tourism. You know, being able to go up, you know, 60 miles, 100 miles, 150 miles, spend the afternoon, and then come back down, we think is going to be a big moneymaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is going to be, you know, industries which we don't know about today, other than in labs, which need a space environment. You know, to get those up there, either they have to, again, you know, in a rocket, you are talking about thousands of dollars a pound and not a whole lot of pounds. You know, in a space elevator, you're talking about maybe hundreds of dollars of pounds or less and a large capacity.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
The people who need that type of thing, you know, that's going to be the customers. You know, I think once it's there, I think it's going to make a ton of money for somebody, you know, maybe for a lot of somebodies, because you want more than one space elevator.
Yes. The first one is the bootstrap that gets you to others.
That's correct. I mean, the purpose of the first space elevator is to build the second one.
Yeah.
And when you've got two, now you're in business, because you know one of your fail-safe scenarios is you know, if something breaks on one space elevator, you've got another one nearby.
Yes.
You know, that you can use for you know, rescue and salvage possibilities.
Yes.
And not salvage, but repair.
So at the conference, the discussion is less about what the applications would be and more about how to get it done.
That's correct.
Yeah. What would you say the conclusions were for this year?
That we're closer than we've ever been before. That, you know, I think you can put, you know, before you'd throw a date out there, like Arthur C. Clarke said that a space elevator would be built 50 years after everybody quit laughing about it. You know, people quit laughing about it some time ago, and I think his prediction is a little bit pessimistic. You know, I think that, you know, that we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 2020 to 2030. To actually be able to put one up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's a general feeling that, you know, this is a real possibility. You know, it could happen in our lifetimes. It's not something we're working at that's going to happen 200 years from now or 500 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people have that feeling. You know, it's just that the technology in the last long pole in the tent, which is this carbon nanotubes, is maturing so rapidly that, you know, we're going to see something in a couple of years that we're going to say, hey, we could actually build this thing now.
Hmm.
So, and I think that excitement was really, really a theme that permeated the conference.
So if I were to attend the Space Elevator Games, what would I see happening there?
You'll see a helicopter lifting a cable 1 kilometer up into the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And then you will see, and this is a steel cable, and then you'll see teams attaching their climbers to this cable,
mm-hmm.
and then using lasers to power photovoltaic cells, to beam at photovoltaic cells, which will turn that energy into electricity, and power motors, which will climb up and down the cable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hoping this year to have several competitors that have a real shot at winning the prize money.
And the prize is to accomplish what?
Well, there's two prizes. There's two levels of prizes. If you can get up the kilometer cable in 2 meters per second and fulfill some other technical issues, there's a $1 million, and you're the only one that does it, there's a $1 million prize waiting there for you. If you can do it at 5 meters per second and you're the only one that does it, then there's a $2 million prize for you.
Really? So $1 million for a laser-powered climber to go a kilometer at 2 meters per second, and no one's claimed that yet.
That's correct. Well, last year last year it was 100 meters, and the year before that it was 50 meters. And last year, the last 2 years, we've had people who have gotten very close. But the technology is maturing, and the prize money is increasing. Last year, the prize money, I think, was $500,000.
And you've raised the bar, it sounds like, each year as well.
We've raised the bar, and we've raised the prize money, correct.
Hmm. So that's one. And what's the other prize?
The other prize is for the tether competition. It's who can make the strongest tether.
Yeah.
And that's also a $2 million prize. Again, it's levels. You know, there's a $1 million prize. There's a $2 million prize.
Right.
And basically, you have to beat the house tether. You're allowed to have a tether that's 2 grams in weight. The house tether can be 3 grams in weight. The house tether is built off of commercially off-the-shelf material. And so if you bring something new, some new technology like a nanotube tether, and it can beat a tether which is 50%, has a 50% cheating factor, basically, it's more weight than yours,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're eligible for a $1 million or a $2 million prize.
So the house tether is You said 3 grams?
It's 3 grams.
And it's what length?
It's, I got to look it up. I think it's 2 meters.
Oh, okay. So nothing like the kilometer climb,
no,
right?
No. It's a loop that's 2 meters long. And so you have to bring your own loop, which is can weigh no more than 2 grams.
Okay.
And then basically these two are put onto a machine which was constructed specifically for this event, which then applies pressure to both tethers equally.
Okay.
Whichever one breaks first loses.
And the people who have come closest to winning have used what technology?
Well, no one's come close to winning on the tether competition yet.
Okay.
There was a team from, I don't know where they're based out of, Astro Aeronea, who won the competition 2 years ago in that they provided the strongest tether, but they weren't strong enough to beat the house tether.
Okay.
This year, this last year, again, they were the strongest, but they chose not to compete against the house tether, believing that they really had no chance against it, so they didn't want to do it.
Okay.
But last year, we also had our first carbon nanotube tether. Which came, yes. MIT brought it. They work in conjunction with the Nanocom Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually created a 2-meter-long carbon nanotube tether, which was just really exciting to see. But it had been done so closely to the competition, they weren't able to weave it into a continuous cable.
Mm.
So they actually tied a knot to put the thing
together. They tied a knot?
Yeah, I know. It was bad. So they put it on there and it
broke
that knot.
I think that's great. I think it's great that they did that. It's like it just brings it all down to earth in a sense, right?
Exactly. But this year they've got a year to do it. I'm sure we're going to see something much, much better from them. And they've confirmed that they're coming. We know of at least one other tether team we think that's going to make it. So hopefully this year we're actually going to have competition between carbon nanotube tethers, which would just be way cool. So our ideal scenario this year is that we have a carbon nanotube tether, which just blows away the house tether, and we have somebody who does the climb in a 5 meter per second.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've really accomplished what we were supposed to accomplish and what NASA is paying us to accomplish.
And this will happen where?
It's in October, and right now the current scenario is, and it's not even definite yet, but we're hoping for Meteor Crater in Arizona. And we were going to actually do it in the crater itself with a balloon, but there were just too many issues with that. So now the current plan is to put it on the edge of the crater, and the cable will be held up by a helicopter. And there doesn't seem to be any technical issues with that, but they're still ironing out. The Spaceward Foundation, who's the group that hosts this thing, they're still ironing out some of the details.
Mm-hmm. You say we in all of this, and clearly your role here is more than that of simply a chronicler of this movement and effort on a blog, right? You're involved in the Spaceward Foundation.
That's correct. I'm a volunteer for the Spaceward Foundation.
Yeah. And so what does that entail?
You know, handling press inquiries, dealing with the press when they come to the games,
mm-hmm.
and whatever else needs to be done while I'm there.
And what is the Spaceward Foundation?
Spaceward Foundation, it's a 501c3 organization based out of Mountain View, California. Their website is www.spaceward.org, and when NASA sponsors these prizes, and you know they've done several of them, they don't run the competitions themselves. They find an organization to partner with.
Okay.
So different organizations do the grunt work to get the competition going, and so Spaceward is the group that's doing the space elevator games, the power beaming, and the strong tether competition.
Okay.
And NASA is just providing the money.
And the funding that NASA is providing is so far entirely associated with the support of the elevator games?
Well, for this competition, yes. I mean, they've also got other competitions that they sponsor. There's the Moon Regolith competition, and there's the Lunar Glove the Glove competition. Sponsoring.
Yeah, but I mean in terms of, its sponsorship of the space elevator concept.
Yes, right. There's those two competitions.
Okay. And so that's effectively, it's the prize money that they're offering, or is there additional
No, it's
support?
The prize money.
Yeah, okay.
And plus
okay.
They have a representative there who validates the results.
It's very inspiring to think about all of this and to...
Inspiring being on the inside, too.
It must be great.
It really is. You know, I got into this just because I was curious, you know, and now I'm a huge fan. And I'm going to do whatever I can to make it happen.
One of the delightful things I'm sensing about this movement or this effort is that it is, in fact, attracting a variety of people from all sorts of disciplines and all walks of life, you know, who are kind of just showing up and wanting to participate and finding ways to participate. I mean, Maurice, for example, has now made a really important contribution to this project. by organizing this year's conference, and he is absolutely just an interested and passionate, I guess you would say, amateur in the best sense of the word.
Yep.
And
yep.
But you know, he was describing examples of some people who also sort of showed up to the conference with, you know, serious engineering cred and made real contributions.
Yeah, you know, he's right, and we need more people like Maurice. I mean, he's, you know, they're going to be the lifeblood of this thing at the end of the day, because you've got to convince the public that this is a good idea. And convincing people like Maurice, you know, goes a long way to do that.
I don't think he needed any convincing. I think he liked it right off the bat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you get in and you learn what it can do, and you learn that this is actually, you know, not some science fiction idea that's never going to happen. I mean, we're actually getting close here.
Well, I think that's the main thing. You know, I mean, until I sort of went through some reading and some discussions with you guys, it was kind of like, yeah, this is this,
yep,
you know, this is this vague idea, you know. But when you actually sort of, when you actually understand that there are serious people who have serious engineering credentials and are working this problem in an incredibly pragmatic and procedural way, then, you know, it starts to sink in that, yeah, it might not happen, but it could.
Yeah. There are too many of us who are spending too much time on this, which we would not be doing if we thought it was just, you know, a pipe dream.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks very much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation, too. I'll be interested to see how the interview comes out.
Okay.
All
thanks,
right.
Thanks very much, Ted.
Okay, thank you, John.